I would like to give the floor to Andy Storey, who will complement a couple of aspects that have already been covered and then focus on the Irish referendum.
Okay, thank you very much. And thanks to Kenneth for doing a lot of the work I feared I would have to do. So that's great. And Angela said that I would compliment his presentation. So it was great. Well done. I've hereby complimented it. Okay, well, I mean, in a sense, what I want to talk about is the kind of instrumentality of the crisis, and it is hopefully complementing, providing kind of some synergy with Kenneth's account. Kenneth's talked about the way in which the source of the crisis lies in essentially current account imbalances within the European Union, the accumulation of current account surpluses by highly competitive exporters, in particular by Germany, the accumulation of corresponding deficits by peripheral countries, my own, Ireland, but also a number of others, and how, in a sense, that was compensated for by the growth of private sector debt, private sector indebtedness, as core country surpluses were recycled into the periphery in the form of cheap credit, essentially, in the case of Ireland, but also Spain, fueling a property price bubble. And, of course, when those bubbles burst, we saw the massive socialisation of private sector debt, whereby governments took on responsibility for the repayment of bank debt. That's the actual source of the crisis, as opposed to the mythical story that Kenneth referred to of public sector profligacy predating the crisis, with the partial exception of Greece. And it's even there, it's a partial exception. That's simply not the case. However, one could make the argument that, therefore, the EU, to some extent, or the EU leadership has misdiagnosed the crisis and is implementing, you know, incorrect policies. And there's some truth in that, but I also think you have to see that within the broader context of the long-term logic of economic and monetary union. In a sense, I would argue the logic of EMU was always to ensure that no individual member state could respond to national popular protest or economic difficulty by making what you might term concessions, especially in the area of monetary policy. And obviously, economic and monetary union meant that printing money, lowering the interest rate, devaluing the currency, all of those tools of responding to a crisis were taken away from governments that signed up to EMU. The point being to ensure that no one state could, as it were, go soft and make excessive concessions to its own popular domestic constituencies. Instead, adjustment had to take place entirely through cuts in wages and cuts in the social wage of the welfare state, what economists call internal devaluation. Steve McGiffin, long-time critic of European economic governance, quotes an anonymous neoliberal economist who predicted that the onset of EMU, either the euro subverts the welfare state or Europe's welfare state subverts the euro. Smart money, he argued at the time, should bet on the euro. The Stability and Growth Pact, which Kenneth has referred to, was likewise supposed to ensure that no one state could deal with economic and or political pressures by overly expansionary fiscal policy, though the flouting of the Stability and Growth Pact rules by, in the first instance, Germany and France, indicated the scale of the political challenge that represented. And in a sense, this is where the fiscal treaty and its predecessors, the six-pack and so on, come in. It's an attempt to impose almost as rigid restrictions on government's fiscal room for manoeuvre as currently pertain in the area of monetary policy. So if you are legally or perhaps even constitutionally obliged to curtail your levels of deficit and debt, then once again the burden of adjustment is being entirely placed upon ordinary people, this time through the sorts of spending cuts and tax increases that Kenneth referred to. So my point here, and the first point I really want to make, is that to claim that the current crisis reveals a fundamental design flaw in economic and monetary union, to a certain extent at least, I think misses the point. The point was to ensure that the hand of capital was strengthened over labour and to ensure that crisis situations saw governments deprived of the political wherewithal to respond to the demands of their electors with any flexibility in monetary or fiscal policy. So when writers like Paul Krugman and Joseph Stiglitz describe the current European response to the crisis as being in some sense insane, and Krugman uses that term of insanity. I think the strategy may be self-defeating, and we can talk about that later, but it's not mad. It has its own, its logic, and in a sense it's the coming to fruition of a long-cherished project, what McGiffen refers to as a project to abolish the tiresome influence of popular democratic institutions on macroeconomic policy. Okay. Now, is there some indication in the last few days or weeks that that might be about to change? And obviously there's been a lot of speculation in the context of the election of Hollande that there will be some kind of growth pact or growth treaty to complement the fiscal treaty. And you've even had nods in that direction coming from Mario Draghi, the president of the European Central Bank, and Chancellor Merkel. However, I think what's important here is, and this perhaps is the second main point I want to make, that we don't get sucked into what I would see as a kind of a trap here, where growth means different things to different people. When people like Draghi refer to growth, what they really mean is structural reforms on the supply side, especially in the labour market. They don't mean tackling the crisis of domestic demand. I would also argue that once the treaty is passed, I think you'll probably see even that language dissipate to some extent. But this, I think, is a quote that captures that from the Swedish finance minister, speaking, in fact, in Germany a couple of months ago, saying growth-enhancing measures, very explicitly, are not about stimulating demand. They're about releasing growth through removing, in this case, regulatory barriers to entry in domestic service sectors. So any growth measure that is likely to be introduced is very likely to involve further liberalisation rather than standard Keynesian demand stimulus. And in a sense, what that shows is that even in at this stage of the crisis is being used in kind of what Naomi Klein would term kind of classic shock doctrine mode to ram through yet further reforms. And just another example of that is the head of the Bundesbank in November of last year talking about how the fact that Italian bond yields were rising was actually good because market interest rates play a role in pushing governments towards reforms. And if the European Central Bank were to step in and start buying sovereign bonds, that would mean that you would mute, as he put it, the incentives that come from the market. So, but you can actually use the crisis itself to push through, again, in this case, structural reforms of the Italian pensions, labour market, privatisation, etc. Okay, that was, how did I do? 5 minutes for the context. Okay, 6 minutes. Let me turn my attention to, because I'm also conscious of time, you have a chance to speak as well. In Ireland, uniquely in the European Union, we are going to have a referendum on the fiscal treaty because of the peculiar nature of the Irish Constitution. That's going to happen on the 31st of May. Campaign really only got going last week, and as of now, there are three main arguments that the yes side, which includes the government, and I'll come back to the balance of forces in a moment, are using. The first is the treaty doesn't really make any difference because we need to balance our books anyway. It's something we'd have to do regardless. Second argument is that if we don't ratify this treaty, then we won't be able to access the European Stability Mechanism that Kenneth referred to, this bailout. And Ireland, of course, has already received one so-called bailout, a loan from the European Union and the IMF and some other bilateral lenders. So in a sense, we would, if we were not able to access the private financial markets, this is the kind of insurance policy. And then thirdly, there's a kind of more nebulous set of arguments around a no vote deterring investment or in some other way damaging confidence in the economy. So taking each of those in turn, balancing the books, the argument is that this would make no difference. Now, part of the problem here is that we can't say for sure what difference it would make. It will partly depend on what the rate of GDP growth is, and it will partly depend on how the structural deficit is calculated. But there is certainly a strong argument that it will ensure, or will likely ensure, that there will be further austerity at the end of the current adjustment period in Ireland. One estimate is that the structural deficit could be somewhere in the region of 3.7% by 2015. If that has to be brought down to 0.5%, and again, there's debate about the scale and schedule for that, that is likely to lead to fairly substantial additional austerity measures, one estimate being that that could equate to a 5.7 billion euro gap in 2015 that would have to be phased out over the following years. And it would have to be phased out in conjunction with something that Kenneth also adverted to, which is that you will have a generalised austerity drive right across the eurozone, because some 23 or 24 countries are likely in breach of the structural deficit rule. So as one commentator has said, we'll all be stagnating together, but your misery loves company, so you know it'll be all right. But these are some figures, and I apologise, these are kind of rough and ready. They're not even properly aligned. They're taken from two different sources. The first column is taken from IMF forecasts about what the average annual GDP growth rate will be between 2012 and 2016 in percentage terms. And the second set of figures are taken from a report produced by the Macroeconomic Policy Institute based in Dusseldorf and to other economic research organisations based in France and Austria. And they've done some calculations on what the likely growth scenarios will be under the fiscal treaty. Now, this is obviously to some extent speculative, but if you look at the European Union and the Eurozone as a whole, you can see that under the fiscal treaty scenario, you're looking at significantly reduced growth projections. And in the case of Italy, for example, you're looking at what is already almost anemic or flatline growth deteriorating into an economic contraction year on year on average over that period. Now, the significance of that, apart from its generalised problems for the Eurozone as a whole, is that a lot of Irish commentators claim that exports will be the kind of panacea for the Irish recovery. If our major export markets are facing into significantly reduced or negative growth, then that assumption starts to look a little shaky. Second argument is that if Ireland doesn't vote yes, then it will be denied access to the new so-called bailout mechanism, the European Stability Mechanism. That's true. The terms of the treaty are very clear on that a country that does not ratify the treaty cannot access this new bailout fund. And that's actually been the kind of core of the debate in Ireland for the last week or 10 days. There are a number of responses to that. One, I think, probably to my mind, the most convincing response is the EU heads of state communique after their summit on the 30th of January last, where they said that we will continue to provide support to countries under a programme until they have regained market access. That's, of course, Greece, Portugal and Ireland, the three countries that are under a programme in that sense at the moment. If, as has been the case, the European Union has not been prepared to let even zombie banks go to the wall and stop paying their debts, it's highly unlikely they're going to let a country go to the wall and not provide it with the wherewithal in terms of recycling loans to cover its debts. Now, there are a number of other issues there. Obviously, we're into a certain level of imponderables here or unknowables. There's also issues there about how we would access other sources of funding. There's a relationship here around another campaign I'm involved in for the cancellation of illegitimate debt, some of that aforementioned private sector debt that has been socialised in the Irish context, and we've been campaigning for that to be suspended with a view to it being written down. There are also issues here around how alternative funding could be generated through increased taxation. Taxation rates in Ireland remain, in certain areas at least, remarkably low. There's also an interesting argument that's been put forward by a website in Ireland called Nama Wine Lake. I don't have time to explain where the name comes from, but it's an interesting story in its own right. Arguing that, in fact, a no vote could be very good for the campaign to try and get the debt written down, because a no vote would signal that Ireland is willing to be inconvenient and un-European or non-European. And if we're willing to vote no, then maybe one day we'll actually disown the promissory notes, which is one category of what we would argue is illegitimate debt. So if we're willing to be a bit stroppy and a bit uppity, we might actually get somewhere, not just on the fiscal treaty, but on the debt issue more generally. The third argument for a yes vote is, as I said, the more intangible sense that there'll be some kind of impact on investment, especially on foreign investment. It's hard to find empirical backing for that. More recently, there's been a threat from the Minister for Finance that if there's a no vote, he's going to have to introduce an even harsher budget in 2013 because he argues that economic growth projections will actually be cut. And there was an earlier argument that, in fact, this is really a referendum on European, on membership of the euro, which it's not. But in a sense, and I'm not trying to be too flippant here, this is really it's kind of scare tactics, really, in terms of the Yes campaign, and this kind of captures its essential nature, I think. Okay. In terms of, I think that's taking on Yes arguments. In terms of No arguments, I think the fundamental issue, and it's one that Kenneth's already very eloquently described, at heart, to my mind, whatever about the economic consequences, and obviously there can be a legitimate debate around that, I would argue that the consequences will, on balance, probably be negative, there is a fundamental curtailing of democracy at work here. The treaty is passed, the Irish government, and this will apply to all other governments who sign up to it, will introduce legislation concerning the debt brake, the structural deficit, etc. What happens if a future government, in a few years' time, decides we're not abiding by these rules and decides to repeal the legislation? At that point, a government is very clearly in breach of an article of the treaty, and another contracting party, another member state, can take Ireland to the European Court of Justice for being in breach of its treaty obligations. So a country, and Ireland is obviously it's a live debate in Ireland at the moment, but it applies right across the board, a country could be taken to court, essentially, for choosing to alter its economic policy. I think that raises very fundamental questions about democracy. Balance of forces, the government and the largest opposition party are supporting the treaty. Most of the main employers and farmers groups are also supporting it. Some left-leaning or left-wing parties within the parliament are opposed, notably Sinn Féin, which is currently running at about 20% in the opinion polls. I think about the same percentage as the Socialist Party at the moment in Ireland. Okay. And some smaller left-wing parties. And some independent members of parliament are also opposed. Four trade unions have come out calling for a no vote. The largest single union and the umbrella body for trade unions have decided that they're not going to call for a yes or a no vote. They're kind of hedging their bets on this one. That goes back to traditions of social partnership and close cooperation between the trade union leadership and the Irish government. The media tends to be fairly supportive of status quo government positions. However, one of the curiosities of an Irish referendum is that the media is obliged to give equal time to both sides of the debate, which means there is a chance, even if it turns out to be a yes vote, it's an interesting opportunity because it provides an opportunity for dissenting voices or critical voices to be heard in a way that would not otherwise, they would not otherwise be heard. Okay, so how do I think it'll go? I think it's going to hinge upon two factors, whether fear wins or anger wins. There's a lot of fear out there. People are very high levels of unemployment, emigration, high levels of personal debt, a lot of insecurity around people who do have jobs. If that fear factor kicks in, I think it'll be a yes vote. There's also a lot of anger out there. There's been a recent campaign against the introduction of new flat rate household charges, kind of a poll tax. Over half the population refused to pay or chose not to pay those charges, reflecting a widespread discontent with austerity. Will that translate into a no vote? It might. I've been listening to Bruce Springsteen's incendiary new album of late, Wrecking Ball, which includes the refrain in the title track of holding tight to your anger and not falling to your fear. I'm kind of hoping that come 31st of May we'll hold tight to our anger and not fall to our fear. Thank you.